This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I'm an epidemiologist. I think one of the silver linings of a pandemic is we no longer have to explain what an epidemiologist is, that we are not skin doctors. But we look at disease patterns. And, I was at the forefront of the COVID pandemic out in the field after, being in a professorship position. But during my journey, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic, I found a very big emergency beyond a disease and one of miscommunication of rumors and falsehoods. And so I'm going to really focus on my journey and the lessons learned throughout the past 6 years in this space. And because I've learned a lot, I've never got 1 hour of one course of communication. So a lot of this is and has been trial by error and trial by fire. But first, I wanted to start with a story. So when vaccines first rolled out, many people were confused, right? A lot of people were hopeful, but a lot were also very skeptical. A lot of people heard rumors, right, that the vaccine was rushed, that it could change your body in strange ways, that it came from something very unnatural. And people worried about side effects, and they worried about government overreach, wondering, right, who's exactly behind this vaccine, who were behind the public health orders to mandate vaccines. And people preferred natural remedies, clean air, good food, prayer, over a foreign substance entering their body. Now, raise your hand if any of that sounds familiar. I know, thank you, everyone's hands. And you're probably thinking about COVID-19, and you're not wrong, but the story I'm talking about is actually not from 2020. It's also not even from 1920. It is from 1802. And that year, there is this cartoon that swept across London depicting very terrified people who had just received the smallpox vaccine. Out of their arms and heads and faces, there's these grotesque parts of cow parts bursting, right? Tails, hooves, snouts, as the vaccine itself were basically turning people into cattle. The smallpox vaccine had cowpox serum in it, and the fear was very real back then. It was the first time in human history that a doctor was suggesting that a disease from a cow could prevent something in a human. The boundaries between nature and science and faith and medicine and body and government all were blurred at once. The fear wasn't just about science, it was about trust. And for the first time, people were asked to believe that something they couldn't see, right, a drop of cowpox that could turn into a deadly virus, and this invisible protection that they couldn't see either. And this is what has always been asked of public health, is to believe in the unseen, to believe that clean water prevents cholera, that seatbelts on non-smoking areas saves lives, that a vaccine made from a cow can prevent smallpox infection. And the cartoon may seem absurd, maybe it doesn't seem absurd these days, but it still definitely echoes. And today, it is no longer on the edges, right? Falsehoods, rumors, distrust are not just confined in a small area of the United States. It's very much mainstream now. And they are shaping elections. It is shaping policy, and it is determining who lives and who dies right now. And so to me, what we are experiencing during COVID and what we are also experiencing right now is this five-alarm fire of invisibility, right? Because if people can't see it and they can't feel it and they do not understand how it touches their lives, it will be dismantled piece by piece. And in many ways, that is already happening. So today, invisibility, which is often a badge of honor, right? We have these sayings that when public health works, it's invisible. And we saved your life today and you didn't even know it. We have even a three-part PBS series called The Invisible Shield. It's no longer a badge of honor. It's an existential threat that we really have to address and address now and address very quickly. So whenever we look at public health challenges, it's always important. And the first thing we try to figure out is etiology, right? What is the cause? And if rumors have always been a thing around vaccines since the 1800s, why is it so potent now? Why are we seeing it everywhere? Why are so many people believing falsehoods and rumors? Well, the world around us has changed, and it's changed incredibly dramatically. One way is that the information landscape has changed. It's shifted. People no longer trust the government, and they no longer even trust the news. In fact, only 30% of Americans trust in the news overall. We have social media. It's a huge part of how people get their healthcare information online. In fact, 1 in 2 Americans get their health-related information on social media. Unfortunately, right, social media platforms are optimized for engagement, which means that content that is sensationalism or emotionally charged gets the most attention. So this makes it far easier for false information, for fear, for emotionally charged information to go way quicker than the truth can go. In fact, there's this saying, right, that false information spreads around the world before the truth gets its pants on. And this is a thing that I have just experienced the past 6 years. And we see this in the data too. This was an MIT study done in 2018. So even before the pandemic, they looked at tweets before the X takeover. It was among Twitter. And what they found was that the falsehoods go farther, faster, deeper, and more broadly than the truth. They found that false information reached far more people than the truth, that it was more retweeted than the truth, it spread through more peer-to-peer interaction than the truth, that false news or false information spread 6 times faster than the truth, and it was retweeted by more unique users than the truth, and it was diffused more broadly than the truth. And so what this really tells us is that it sheds new light on the fundamental aspects of our online ecosystem, and we have yet to adapt in public health. Of course, it's not just the information landscape. There's other factors here. We cannot ignore that there are bad actors or a lot of people taking advantage of this system. The anti-vax industry is worth $1.1 billion to big tech right now. They have 62 million followers, a ton of engagement on social media. A lot of people also don't realize that actually only four families control 70% of the anti-vax conversation online. Children's Health Defense, which is founded by now our Health and Human Services Secretary, was responsible for 1 in 4 misinformation tweets about the COVID-19 vaccine during the pandemic. Now, why do they do this? Oh, I get that question a lot. Well, it's not rocket science. It is to turn a profit for links, for natural remedies, four major nonprofits that rose to prominence during the COVID-19 pandemic were capitalizing on the spread of medical misinformation. They gained more than $100 million in 1 year during the COVID pandemic. It's a very lucrative business. We've also seen not only, or maybe in tandem with this information landscape, also the rise of this curiosity-driven class, like I like to call it. You can Google anything right now, right? You don't need Dr. Jedalina telling you something around a vaccine. You can just Google it. We'd never more had more information at our fingertips. So you have this rise of self-efficacy, the spike to believe that the average person can know as much as their physician, especially young people right now. There's this recent Edelman report that younger people are 2 times more likely than the average person to say that they know more or as much as their physician. At the same time as this, you also have this rise of this influencer world, that people with the most influence on people's health isn't people with MDs or PhDs, it's those who have gained trust with their audience online. There is a reason why Joe Rogan is the most influential public health communicator in the world, even if it's not evidence-based, because he earned the trust and legitimacy with his audience for years and years and years. And then he started communicating from that foundation, not just about facts or mistruths, but around accessibility, among relatability, around frequency and relevance. And given all of that, he gained a ton of influence around health decisions. We also cannot ignore where we are in this moment with an elephant of the room, that we are in the heels of the COVID pandemic and a ton of lost trust. Lost trust in vaccine and safety, lost trust in the systems, lost trust in the policymakers, especially off of the pandemic, where values of public health just didn't align with the values of some communities. And because of this, we're also seeing this in the numbers, a decline in trust in institutions, a decline in trust in scientists and medical scientists since 2016, but particularly since the pandemic, and particularly among Republicans losing a great deal of trust among scientists. So I have been trying to navigate this world. I didn't know about any of this 6 years ago, but I was just this really lonely, normal epidemiologist, and was really trying to lean in at the moment of like how to meet the moment at the time of the biggest public health emergency we've had. So in March of 2020, my dean came to me actually at the University of Texas and was like, Caitlin, can you just update our faculty, staff, and students on like what the heck is happening with this virus? And I was like, fine, I can do that. And so I wrote these emails. They're called my daily data-driven updates, about to, 30, 40 people, and really ugly Excel graphs, only a few sentences of like what was going on, what I was following in the news, what I was following in the data, but also what I was doing as a parent. I had an 8-month-old. I was also about 4 months pregnant at the time. And, I was just being real. I signed these emails, love your local epidemiologist, because that's who I was to them. It was a very small, tight-knit group. A few days later, one of my students came to me and was like, Dr. Jedalina, can you just please put this on social media so I don't have to keep copying and pasting your emails on Facebook for my family and friends? And I distinctly remember turning to my husband and telling him, what the hell? I only have to do this for 6 weeks max. And then surely someone's going to pick up the baton and explain to the public in an understandable, timely, actionable manner what the heck was going on. And that never happened. And so I went from social media, I was hacked by anti-vaxxers, and then I went to a newsletter site, and it just grew and grew and grew. None of this was in any epidemiologic playbook. In fact, like I said, I've never been taught anything about communication in my undergrad, graduate degrees at all. But, I got a ton of threats, a lot of people showing up in my house, got FBI involved. I was told to stay in my lane from a lot of colleagues. And I kept going because I truly and still today believe that people deserve better. They deserve better information. They deserve better transparency. And they deserve a better bridge between science and society. And so we're still going. And we now have state-level newsletters. Matt is in charge of our California newsletter. And we're trying to meet the moment in a very different but similar ecosystem that we are in today. Like I said, right now, I'll admit, that was my journey the past 5.5 years, but today feels eerily familiar to March of 2020, right? A storm with very deep uncertainty, one that is incredibly disorienting, and one in which public health and research are under enormous strain. Our systems, to add on to that, are being questioned, they're being dismantled, and they are being defunded. And, you know, as angry as I am, or scared as I am in this moment in the public health field, I also know this, that if we're being honest, like truly honest with ourselves, many of our systems in public health were built for a different time. They haven't kept up with the pace of what Americans need today. And we're at an inflection point right now, and I've seen this inflection point the past few months, is either we can double down on what we know, right, the old systems, the old ways of doing things, or we can listen, we can learn, and we can evolve. Both instincts right now are understandable. Both instincts right now are needed, right? We need a defense and we need an offense right now. But for me personally and Wiley, I am way more interested in the latter, right? Figuring out better ways to serve Americans where they are now, not where we wish they were. And at the center of this is reimagining and rethinking, engaging and communicating, not for Americans, but with Americans. And so I am very focused right now on reimagining our systems for the people. And this means, you know, too often we put on and strap on jet engines onto horse-drawn carriages and wonder why they're like not going faster. And so I'm really in this moment really trying to think through, how do we modernize around people? How do we just stop doing what's not serving people? As well as how do we redesign these broken workflows and build a new infrastructure from the bottom up? And so there's really four things I've been thinking through that I have learned over the past 5 years that I've been trying to bring in this moment. And with one, a goal of making the invisible visible, but also trying to do things differently in public health and how we engage with the public. Okay, so the first step I've been thinking through is moving from information to engagement. So what do I mean by this? As public health workers, as researchers, right, we tend to focus on what's most sexy to us. Data collection tools, doing newest assays, doing data exchange, AI maybe. And don't get me wrong, right, all of these are needed and they're all essential. But none of it matters unless the end user trusts the data or knows what's to actually do with it. So what I have found over the past 5-6 years is that we're often missing this last mile in the scientific discovery ride or journey, and that's data to action or to tell the story. In other words, our job is not done after redesigning the systems or analyzing the data, because our work cannot speak for itself. Communication is not just talking. It's not just a peer-reviewed article behind a paywall. It is translation. It is engagement. It is listening. And it is also activation. So one way we need to do that, to tell our stories, and this may be super obvious, but we need to speak in plain language. We as scientists are absolutely terrible at this. We get stuck in this world of numbers and unable to translate the incredible innovation, the work, the progress, the value, and what we bring to society. And that means because people don't understand it, they won't know, appreciate, fund, or act on our information until we turn it into something useful. Unnecessary complexity really alienates the audience. It really alienates the public. This does not mean dumbing down, but it does mean balancing nuance with understandability, right? Acknowledging uncertainties. I think the biggest lesson I learned over the past 5-6 years is never to underestimate the public. that sure, they don't know what bivalent means, and sure, they don't know what a wastewater surveillance is, but that doesn't mean that they don't want to know, and it also doesn't mean that they don't deserve to know. We have to be a whole lot better at translating our work into plain language. We also have to meet people where they're at, and we have to be creative at this. At CDC, for example, one way we are starting to explore how to meet people where they're at is not just ask them to download another app, but how can we start integrating public health and scientific communication into the weather app, for example. Weather service is the most trusted source of health of information in the United States. How can we meet people where they're at with this? I have a newsletter that lands in people's inboxes. They don't have to come to me for information. I come to them. And I come to them in actually a very personal way, right? Well, think about what else is in your inbox. It's your bank statements. And then it's Wiley. And they don't have to take that extra step. It also means going on social media. Like I said, 1 in 2 Americans are getting their health information on social media. 1 in 2 rural Americans are getting it on Facebook. And so we need to be where people are at. Unfortunately, we're just not very engaging on social media, even if we are there. I love this example that we had of 2 social media posts, one written by scientists saying pasteurization process effectively inactivates H5N1 avian influenza virus in milk. No one knows what that means. Compare that to something else of saying the dairy industry doesn't want you to know about the secret health enzyme, and that goes viral. And so, if it's not spoken in their language, if it's not going to be where they're at, it's just not going to get engagement and it's just not going to reach people. Communicating science is also not only reactive. If I look around right now, if people are on social media or on LinkedIn or trying to communicate science, it seems that we're all in reactive defense mode, right? We're fact-checking. We're saying, no, the science and data doesn't say that. Your numbers are wrong. And a lot of resources are going into what I call reactive communication, right? We have bills going out, or they used to be bills going out. Finland is starting to teach how you spot mis and disinformation in schools. The last FDA really cared about misinformation. Libraries are starting to play an integral role in mis and disinformation. And I'll tell you, like, if I did this lecture, 2 or 3 years ago, I would say, this is throw everything at mis and disinformation. It's the only way, and end of presentation. But what I have discovered and what the reality is that falsehoods and rumors or misinformation is really the tip of an iceberg. Addressing these are reactive. It's a game of whack-a-mole. And really, truly, if we look at the core of what's happening, I estimate about 80% of the decisions out there is not because of misinformation. It is what is below the surface. It is concerns, it is confusion, and it is questions that people cannot find information for. And so this leads to information voids that are incredibly wide. And guess who is ready to fill mis and disinformation? Are rumors and falsehoods on social media. So I urge that, if you're in comms or leadership or an epi, and if you're working on a project, really think through, what are the questions? This is what I ask myself. What does my sister wonder about this, who's not in public health? What questions would she have? And let's bring her along for the scientific ride and not just be reactive, but also be proactive. If we ignore this, or if we try to treat the symptom rather than the cause, we will fail. And we are failing right now. There was this great network analysis done by Johnson and colleagues over computer simulations of Facebook pages. And they looked at Facebook pages that were pro-vax, which are the blue dots, that are anti-vax, which are the red dots, and that are undecided, which are like the green dots. And so like an undecided Facebook page would be, your neighborhood Facebook group garage sales or corgis or something like that. And what they found was really interesting, but I wanted to focus on this figure because there's three big takeaways. One is you can see there's a clear echo chamber, right? Blue dots are clearly separated from red dots. I don't think anyone's really surprised about that. Second is that the anti-vax pages actually tend to have fewer followers. We can see that in the panel D, but they are on more numerous sites. So their reach is far wider than the, like those red dots are far wider than the blue dots that are much more aggregated. And then the third thing, and this is the most important thing about this figure, is that those red dots, the anti-vax sites, are more often linked to discussions on other Facebook pages like parent associations whose stance on vaccination is largely undecided. So that means these red dots are a whole lot closer to those green dots than those blue dots are. And what that means is that pages that explain the benefits of, in the scientific case, for vaccinations, for example, are largely disconnected from the main battlefield of sediment. We are talking to ourselves, basically. And we're not reaching out and we're not being responsive to the narratives that are out there among the undecided. One way to fix this that I have found, one solution, is we have to be more proactive. We have to build a two-way street with the audience. This means that we need to listen instead of hear. Learn together to address the needs on the ground. We really need to open up a relationship with the community. This means that your audience, whoever you're talking to or talking with, our community is not merely a target, but they are an active participant in this process. So that means ask questions, look for questions, get constructive feedback. This may be a town hall about something you're building at the public health department. It may be a feedback form on a dashboard you're creating. It may literally be you going in the comments sections of your department's social media posts to really understand where people are. So listen, read, and also listen and read of things you very much disagree about right now. I made a very active effort for the past couple of months to listen to all, you know, Joe Rogan's podcast, to read Free Press, to try to understand where people are coming from, where the confusions and fears are, to really shape the work for the better and be more responsive to the questions. Importantly, listening doesn't always mean agreeing with everything. And it also doesn't mean validating falsehoods. It doesn't mean abandoning evidence. It doesn't mean dropping all of the values that guide me. This simply just means understanding and like truly understanding what is driving people's fears and frustrations and questions and hopes. Because if we don't listen, then we will continue to build systems that overlook the people that they're supposed to serve. And if we keep missing them, decisions about public health will continue to be made without our input. And we are already living with those consequences right now. One of the hardest two-way streets that I have had to, not had to, I have decided to open is relationships with MAHA. I've been a part of many conversations with them on the ground, I think more than six over the past couple months, because I truly wanted to understand, what drives them and what evidence that they're interested in, how they get their information and how we can meet them in better places. And I've learned a lot from them. I think I've actually learned probably more from them than they maybe have learned from me. I've learned that nuance really matters to them, that context builds trust. I've learned that access is very empowering to them, and they want to be respected in different realities. And when I started listening to them and really integrating their feedback into like one pagers, or, you know, I put together this, the top 12 questions answered around childhood vaccinations, and I sent it to MAHA and asked for their feedback. And they sent me this long email back of really helpful information. And we co-developed this together. And afterwards, I said, thank you. You know, I sent it out to my Wiley community, didn't expect anything more. And they replied back saying, we just sent this out to the entire Maha network because we are so proud that we co-developed this with you. And so there's a lot of value in opening up these two-way streets. It's so hard to do. And you need a lot of patience, but they are truly, truly valuable, especially in moments like right now. The second thing that's really helping me get through this moment is understanding that trust is a practice. It is not a tagline. Institutions love to declare trust, right? Trust us. But it doesn't work that way, right? People don't trust logos. They don't trust brick walls. They don't trust robotic clearance, sterile communications coming up from the CDC. They trust faces. Humans trust other humans. And how do we become more human, right? Even how do we create institutions to become more human, or a research lab, or our science, or our findings to become more human? It's built, one, through transparency, admitting uncertainty, owning mistakes, and following up on your research projects, for example. It's showing up for people rather than telling them all the time. And this means it could be your community lab and opening that up for people to come stop by and see what your lab is all about. It could even be like a storytelling science brewery event. I mean, it's just something that really brings the community along with you and shows that you are a part of the community. Trust is also built through empathy. Remembering that there's always a human on the other side of your communications. People will remember more of how you made them feel rather than what you actually said. And so this means that if you're frustrated with the response, or there's just too much going on and you don't understand where people are coming from, it's a matter of time. And this is what I have to do all the time. Just like take a deep breath. Because don't use words like absurd or insane. Because when you don't show up with empathy, when you show up and respond in a very disconnected way, especially people that are hesitant or believe in conspiracy theories, people will double down because we are rejecting their data and their message. Their views are linked to their identity and the tribes they're a part of, and we need to set new foundations of trust. Third part is just consistency, showing up over and over and over again, reliability over time, even in very small, unglamorous ways, right? It means showing that you're a human, that you make mistakes, you're a warm body, you're a face. I hope everyone who opens my newsletter can actually hear my voice, that anyone who opens Matt's newsletter can hear his voice. And it's not, again, some sterile piece of information that's not useful. I hope it also means credibility is very important with consistency and showing up again and again. This is a picture of Mike Tedros and Maria during the pandemic. And this is like burned into my brain. And because I think that they did an incredible job during the pandemic, they showed up every single week. We got to know them. I got to know when Maria started curling her hair differently because they just kept showing up, even if they didn't have an update. Even if they didn't have an update, they came up on panel, they were online, they're on social media, going on a live, and just started answering questions and being consistent, showing up every single week. And we need to continue to do this in public health as well. Across all of these, though, is that becoming trustworthy means showing, it means communicating that we're fighting for the person. We are not fighting for our institutions, that we're not fighting for science with a capital S, that we're not fighting for our dear bureaucratic processes, that we're not just fighting for our tenure, but we are fighting for the people. This is a mistake I have seen over and over and over again the past couple months, where people are screaming about their NIH funding getting cut, and that Trump is being unfair, or that RFK doesn't know what he's talking about. But people are watching, and people are watching, and they're seeing that we're not defending the peoples that work helps produce and helps support, but we're instead look like we're fighting for the institutions. And 50% of the Americans, or if not more, really want our institutions to burn down. And so that's a good thing to them. So we need to be better at communicating that we're fighting for them, not fighting for our institutions, and explain why. The third thing is, the third principle I've focused on of making the invisible visible is recognizing that and realizing that the deficit model is dead. That people do not need more data and more facts. They need storytellers, they need navigators, and they need narrators. Traditionally, we've had this very top-down approach to public health where we have these, you know, ivory towers, you have CDC, you have FDA, they say something, and then the hope is that they trickle down to all of the households. And that is just not the way our information landscape goes anymore. In fact, it misses a whole lot of households. This means that we don't need the deficit model anymore. We don't need this linear thing. We need a more participatory model. And that means that, sure, ivory towers are still important, that work is important, but that also means that we need to figure out how to equip trusted messengers in the community. And this is physicians, this is pastors, this is librarians, this is local news, this is the chief gossiper of the local postal office in the panhandle of Nebraska. And we need to team together with them and equip them because they are the ones that have the trusted relationships. And this requires a lot of humility. It means recognizing that sometimes you are not the best person for this message. Go find that trusted person for that message. Importantly, though, this the very important aspect of this dynamic model is also this feedback loop. It's the from the bottom up. It means listening. It means embedding real-time feedback loops to share the power, to recognize that communities also bring expertise. It's not just our MDs and PhDs, that people want to be heard, and that there's a recognition that humans have an emotional relationship to information. Hear what their priorities are and what their questions are, not just what your priorities are in public health. It's also about how we communicate and how we talk about data. We need storytelling. Storytelling resonates with people. Stories help connect people with really complex issues on a very personal level. And it tells compelling, it tells actionable stories, it inspires trust and engagement. This is what MAHA is so good at. It is about storytelling. It is about touching on frustrations and fears. It's not necessarily about the evidence or solutions that they have, but they're very good at engaging from the bottom up, especially in storytelling. Emotional appeal is very much often looked over in data, but it plays such a vital role, right? As data scientists, we're taught to take all emotion out of our data and our processes. It makes it so boring for everyone else. And we really need to think through how we can storytell. Think about the emotional journey you want to take them on. Analogies are fantastic ways to, if you don't have a specific story, to really communicate a complex topic. Engagement is also not just what we say, but also how we interact with people when we aren't there. Making data relevant to specific communities, using very clear visuals and providing context, these are essential strategies. And so this means that, you know, this is what I call data storytelling. It's not necessarily like storytelling out of, you know, a story, something you're talking about, but letting it design our data to drive action. Dashboards there's like a billion dashboards. They came out of COVID. One thing I was so frustrated about dashboards, and still even now, is it doesn't tell the end user what to do. Like, it's not very helpful or actionable. And so when I was at CDC, we did this heat risk. I think it's not alive anymore. But we did this like heat risk data that we collected from NOAA, and we triangulated it with all this crazy cool data around health and heat. And the team came to me and they're like, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to do a dashboard and just show heat risk over the location. And I was like, okay, this is a good start, but like, what are you supposed to do? And I was like, who's your end person? And they're like, oh, like a soccer mom. I was like, well, what is a soccer mom going to do with this? I don't even know what to do with this. And so what we ended up doing was then embedding the guidance within this dashboard. So the soccer mom, if that was their end user, could put in their zip code and it would pop up what the heat was with that zip code and what they were what they could do to protect their kid with asthma that was playing soccer in a really hot area. And so we really try to keep that end user in mind, walked them through the data, made it very actionable, made it very hyper-local. And it was used about, I think it was about 200,000 times per month. It was very much used for people to help drive health. The final part of the deficit model, and this is usually where people start like throwing tomatoes at me, is leaning into politics. Politics is typically seen as the third rail in public health, right? Don't touch it lest you get burned. The problem is with that, it ignores that the third rail actually provides power to the train. Public health is inherently political. It means that we have to play the political game, especially if we're leaders. We have to know priorities, economic impacts, workforce stability, right? Family well-being, and align all of our stories and data accordingly. Advocacy isn't just about facts. It's about building trust over time with our policymakers and showing how public health delivers value. So that means we have to use words that resonate with our audience. This is connecting your work when you're talking to policymakers to values and emotions. This was actually a really hard lesson I learned from actually Senator Cassidy, who's in Louisiana. This was a picture I took before I went and had breakfast with him. And I kept talking to him during breakfast about pandemic preparedness, that we just need to do so much of pandemic preparedness. He like looks at me, he's like, Caitlin, I don't care about pandemic preparedness. I care about biosecurity risk. And so what he was teaching me in the moment was like, Caitlin, the words you're using are not resonating with me, and giving me like a tip on like communication skills in the moment of what would resonate with him. And there's also a lot of examples, because words matter. What you say matters. So in my newsletter, you'll never see the word misinformation. That is a trigger word. Instead, we use rumor or falsehoods, for example. Sometimes it doesn't work when we talk about community, and it really works a whole lot better when you say family or your neighbors. Also, right now, everyone loves, bipartisan loves data, loves innovation, loves return on investment right now, and also loves the security. And so figuring out what your strategic choices are, what your battles are to fight, at what time and at what level of government is really important in engagement and communicating right now. Political capital is as scarce as financial resources and needs to be allocated carefully in public health. Here is a return on investment. There's a lot of return on investment in public health programs that can and needs to be communicated over and over again. Okay, final piece of advice. And this is going to sound corny, but it is to be brave. We cannot go back to 2019. We cannot even go back to 2024. The status quo wasn't working, and we are not here to necessarily preserve broken systems. We are here to reimagine what they could be. And if you're reimagining these systems a lot like I am, we are over at YLE, you're going to face a whole lot of resistance. You're going to feel a whole lot overwhelmed, like I feel right now. But be brave enough to reimagine and imagine our future, a better one. Be brave enough to stop working when it's not working and adjust and recreate. It doesn't have to be a public health newsletter that has a ridiculous amount of subscribers. I mean, it can even be from a dashboard someone is creating on your team. It can be an odd bedfellow partner in your community that you start doing community events with. It can just be anticipating questions from the public, from what you're seeing on social media, and trying something new and meeting people where they're at. I think, you know, one thing that's really helping me is letting my values be my compass in this very magnetic storm. It's very hard to find a North Star. I think that when we all stick to the public health values, we'll know where to go next, even if we feel very lost and overwhelmed. Part of being brave, and I'm definitely bringing this up at a university, is that we need to advocate for the environment to do this as well. This sort of communication style, this new way of thinking, needs institutional support. All of this takes time. Time away from people's labs, time away from writing papers and getting them published, time away from writing grants. And so institutions really need to start doing this. When I was going up for tenure in 2021, before I left, I was, you know, you're updating your CV, and my public health newsletter ended up going into one bullet under community service on my CV. Because we are just really, and so academic institutions are really missing the ball on what impact means and what is needed right now. And so really, truly, institutions need to recognize that public health communication and engagement are a scholarly contribution. And it comes from advocacy from within, right? It can be done many ways. It can be done through academic promotion and tenure process, who are rewarding faculty for being out there and communicating a lot, and could be small pilot grants that can secure academics time to focus on scientific communication rather than really the current model where we have to sacrifice nights and weekends for unpaid and unrecognized work in scientific communication. So despite the headlines, the exhaustion that I certainly am feeling in this moment, and the storm we are, realize that trust is not declared, but it is earned over and over and over again. And this means not just focusing on misinformation, but opening up a two-way street and building bridges. It means transparency and empathy and consistency. It means trusted messengers. It means meeting people where they're at and starting to storytell, even if it's so awkward and you don't know how to do it, just starting somewhere. And it means also to be brave, to reimagine the system, to put your neck out there and to think anew. I truly think there's, you know, all of this destruction is happening in public health, and soon we're going to see rubble all around the floor. But I also truly think it is an opportunity. And I really hope that some of these tips, even just one, you don't have to do any of all of these, just one really helps you step further, bigger, and faster, because it is truly all a team effort. So let's end here with cow parts spurting out of bodies. You know, I think that this is a terrified public. We have a very terrified public right now, one that's very misunderstanding science. And we have a profession trying to help people see something that they can't see. And 200 years later, this all, you know, the tools look different, but the challenge hasn't changed at all. We're still here trying to make the invisible visible, because what we do is all, you know, always happens quietly and behind the scenes. So I think the task ahead for us as communicators, as leaders, as academics, is to pull the curtain back, to show what's working, to humanize the systems, to connect the data dots to really the lived experience that people are having, and to let the new generation of thinking really grow and to support that new generation. It's how we build trust. It's how we create value. It is how we ensure that people are not only see public health, but they feel public health in their everyday. And so every chart you make, every dashboard you may create, every policy you may be at the table with, every story is a chance to make the invisible visible. And, you know, it's not just the title of this talk, but it is an all the work. And it's truly the legacy that we are all building and we all need to build together.
My question is, I don't control classes, but what environments and skills can we help students learn while they're students that has traditionally been completely outside the way we think about an MPH?
Oh my God, I have so many ideas for you. So I think that, we need to teach people how to communicate, right? Even, you know, beyond a poster. I mean, I was only taught how to present write a peer-reviewed journal article, and create a poster for a conference. And that is just not what is needed. I mean, that's fine, that's needed. But it's also, we need more than that too. And so that means, like, how do you write an op-ed for New York Times? How do you put together a 30-second elevator pitch if you're at a conference and want to talk about what science you're doing? How is writing a tweet different than an Instagram post that's different than Facebook? Because all of those audiences are completely different given the social media landscape. How do you write a policy brief, right? Like, how do you put together data to try to convince a policymaker around a certain topic that's really important to the state of California? None of those things I was ever taught. And I think that even if you're not in charge of classes, or if it's not a core, what are they called, capabilities of public health programs, there's a word for it, is competency, thank you. Like, it can still be integrated into every class, right? Like, your outcome of a final project doesn't necessarily have to be a PowerPoint. It can be either a policy brief or a social media post or all of them to really start gaining those skills. And I think the more we can equip students with, like, tools to put in their tool belt rather than, like, theoretical ideas, and theoretical is great, but, like, how do we move that to practice is, I think, where we really need to focus right now, and what's needed in the field too. So yeah, just some ideas. I haven't thought about this at all.
Hi there. I'm also with the social impact team at Berkeley Public Health. And the other big thing that's come up over and over again is a reckoning around COVID, around what happened and some of the mistakes that were made, perhaps, in public health, or more broadly by our policymakers, and where we went too far, perhaps. And how do we acknowledge that in a way that is going to make sense to the broader population?
Yeah, I mean, this is why I have been so disappointed we haven't had, like, a 9/11 commission. Like, we haven't had a COVID commission like we had 9/11. I think that would heal a lot of wounds, honestly. I mean, I think the first thing is, even if you don't have that commission, you know, a few states have put together their own reflections on what they did right, what they did wrong, and how they're going to fix it for next time. I think New Jersey was one of them. A few states have done them. But even if you're thinking more on the hyper-local level, I mean, it's truly a self-reflection and admitting what we did wrong, too. I made a lot of mistakes during the pandemic, and I wrote about them in one of my newsletters in, like, 2022 or something, and it went viral. Because, you know, I think people recognize that we're all humans, but they also want to recognize that a lot of their lives were dramatically impacted. A lot of people lost a lot of other people, of family members. And I think the worst thing that could come out of this is we don't learn from that. So I don't know what it looks like. I don't know. You know, maybe it's a conversation up here of, like, just a fireside chat of, like, what happened and what are we doing to make it better in the future. I think it comes to come from both sides too. There were a lot of mistakes, and I think a lot of, you know, hindsight is always 20/20. And so I think it needs to be a fair discussion as well. And so you'd probably have to, like, find a moderator for that so people don't start punching. But, like, I think that's all truly what's needed. You know, I've been incredibly disappointed that, for example, Fauci hasn't come forward about what he got right and what he got wrong. And, you know, probably some of that is because, like, people truly want to kill him. But also, I think it would go far in some circles. And I think it would do a lot. And I think it would do a lot to build trust in this moment as well.
I'm an old, not yet retired epidemiologist. I've spent the last 45 years building databases and surveillance systems and natural history studies. Data has been my life, but I'm not very good at translation. And I want to join a volunteer army of public health veterans that helps to not just save, but revitalize and reimagine public health. And that's, I love what you're doing. I rushed here to see you today. I want to be part of your effort. Matt, I was sort of happy to know you were here. I once worked with Marin County and love that there's a California piece of this. I want to join your efforts. And I imagine there's others like me who are ready to jump in. So I just wanted to say,
let's
put
go.
Me to work. Put me to work somewhere. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I think right now there's a lot of people that want to do a lot. I think what really important piece we're missing is like, what is the vision we're going towards? Like, what is a healthier America? I think right now a lot of people, what I've heard from Maha is that they are following RFK because he is reimagining the systems. And of course we, I don't know, of course, some of his things I don't agree with, but we're also not providing an alternative path to, of like, how are we gonna do this? What is that vision? What is the utopia we're going for? And, you know, I think the abundance is really an important framework for that too. I think that in order to activate a lot of people, we also need to know where we're all running towards too. And finding what that North Star is I think where leadership really needs to step in right now.
I'm from the Center for Emerging and Neglected Diseases, and Berkeley is very well known for its basic science. And so my background is public health, and I've been in a lot of meetings where people say, yes, public health, inherently political science, must be apolitical for it to work and for people to believe it. Mm. But I think that as we've seen, people didn't saw public health and global health coming down in the beginning of this administration and went, well, yeah, it's political. And then science sort of was on the chopping block. And I'd love to hear what you think, just off the top of your head, is a good argument against the idea that scientists are not communicators because they must be neutral.
Yeah, I just don't agree with that. I'm a scientist like that has way too big of a mouth, I guess. You know, I will say, like, there's definitely a culture that needs to change within science. And, you know, I always talk, I sometimes go and give talks, and, you know, I talk about all the death threats I've gotten and people showing up at my house and sending me packages and all this sort of stuff. But truly, like, what is far worse than death threats are the 1,000 paper cuts from colleagues. And not them not getting the value of meeting the public where they're at, bringing them along for the ride. And I think you truly can do that in a non-political way. You won't go viral as easily, and I think that's also okay. It depends what your objective is. And I do think that there's a difference between doing science at the bench and figuring out what mRNA does or, you know, what they do at the bench, and then also what it means for community work, and then what it means for translation to policy. And when you go across that spectrum, it does get inherently more political because politics depends on what's funded and what is who the leaders are and how effective we can be as epidemiologists in one state compared to another state. I also think, like, as our culture may or may not change among science, it's also okay if people don't want to be the communicators, right? There's risk to it. I will just say out loud, like, there is risk to communicating science, both professionally and personally. But my ask to people that don't agree with this or don't want it is to don't want to enter the arena is to support those that are, because it can be incredibly lonely being out there, putting your neck out there. And I think that even if scientists don't want to do it themselves, or they can go support others that are. And I guess that would be my reaction to that. But It is hard. It is definitely a culture within science. And it's just not been working. And I think it's one really clear reason why people want to burn down institutions right now. And I don't know if I disagree with them, because they don't see themselves in it and they don't see the value it's bringing to them.
So I've been in public health for 29 years, mostly local, then at the state. And what you were describing there, we've seen it in public health. And I think, for example, the HIV epidemic, because a lot of getting to zero was about working in the community.
Yep.
And so I feel like that was a real success story in terms of getting HIV incidence down. And then in governmental public health is always under a political structure. So we can't say anything. So we depend on people like you.
That is correct.
to be the voice. And so what I see as different is that you really learn, where I feel like is new for public health agencies, is the digital space. I feel like you figured out how to work in the digital space in a very effective way. And so thank you so much for everything you did. And I think to me, that's the real difference. And I feel like that's the frontier area for us.
It is very much, thank you. It's very much frontier. I have a few reactions. One with the HIV AIDS epidemic, as well as, you know, community health workers during COVID. I think the challenge is with all of those is that we get ourselves in the cycle of panic and neglect with funding. And there's very little sustainability for these programs to continue during peacetime. And I think that, you know, changing our funding lines and figuring out, like, focusing on infrastructure to continue to have community health workers, for example, no matter what the age and day is really important. The other thing I realized, especially after my work at CDC and the White House, was that there's this huge need and gap that needs to be filled outside of government. And I think this is where you're going at. And one of the things I was most concerned about with my newsletter was stepping on the toes of my colleagues that are out in the field and in government positions. But what I have found is that they welcome us with open arms and truly see ourselves as a partner, a public-private partnership. Because there are things. It's not just like we know the digital age, but I can go email 450,000 people like right now if I wanted to, right? Like it's how fast you can be too. And it's also, yeah, we're not connected in politics. I mean, one lesson I learned, and this probably sounds really silly, but at CDC, it was so political. You couldn't talk about some virus because the president was talking to China about something other, like another thing, right? It was just so, so within the political infrastructure. And that was, you know, during all sorts of administrations. And we just don't have to worry about that. I mean, Matt and I are like, what do we think, right? And we send it out. So there's a lot of things that we can do. There's a lot, though, that we also need from government public health. And I think figuring out what that partnership looks like and truly becoming a team is what we're so excited to be doing in California right now. Matt.
Thank you, Caitlin. It's so inspiring just to hear you, despite the fact that I get to talk to you regularly. Just, so thank you. The one question I have around the, you know, there's that graphic of the ivory towers and the households, and then the middle layer of the trusted messengers. You know, following up on Tomas's observation that part of what the magic that you have brought is enabled by new media, like new forms of communication, and we know that those have really taken over as the primary means of information exchange in society. You know, Mr. Beast, you know, has, I don't know how many millions, billions maybe, you know, and, compared to like New York Times or LA Times, like what are sort of known institutions of truth and conveyance of communication and information are much lower actually in terms of their impact than these kind of random influencers who are probably characterized more by just their charisma and their energy and and can say whatever they want, right? But they reach people that way. What we're trying to do is sort of marry that way of sort of an influencer space with the rigor and a very conservative background of science, right? Which is way too slow. And you're sort of like Stretch Armstrong in between those two worlds of being an influencer, but actually bringing into that space the rigor and the trustworthiness of evidence-based science. But there's one of you. And I'm wondering whether or not some of those trusted messengers might also be other influencers that are established in the world of influence, where they might actually be able to communicate science and messages. So getting Mr. Beast to actually like talk about science a little bit, right? Take advantage of that infrastructure that has just naturally emerged as what people are listening to, rather than have to build science influencers from the ground up.
Yeah. So I didn't get into this, but we have to break echo chambers, like plain and simple. One way that I've started doing this, I have a public health information company. One of them is the newsletter, but there's also other programs. One is called the Evidence Collective, which is 30 scientific influencers with a reach of about 200 million to create a surround sound approach on social media. The challenge with that is scientific communicators are also talking to the same audience. And so what we actually did last week was we had a convening with mom influencers. So like people going, you know, shopping at Target and like putting on makeup, like nothing to do with science. And we invited them to like, you know, start relationships and partnerships with scientific influencers as well. And it was magical. Like it was in, like these moms are getting questions about Hep B. They're getting questions about MMR and why we don't have three separate vaccines. And they're so thankful to have access to resources of people that can help them navigate their followers. And so what you start creating is like networks of networks. Where the next one we're going to be doing is faith-based influencers too. And I truly think that is one way we can start again this surround sound approach. This isn't like novel. This is exactly what Children's Health Defense does. Is they have this network of all these communicators online, content calendar of what's going to be talked about that week. And so if you're on social media, it looks like everyone from everywhere is saying that mRNA vaccines cause cancer, but it's actually just like one source that's equipping all these other brands to talk about it in their own voice, own manner, et cetera, own brand. And so I think, I mean, that's one way we can start exploring that. How to scale it with like zero financial support is another question, but we'll get there when we get there. But I think this is exactly where, you know, these people have already have trusted relationships with their audience. They've already created that. Like, how can we help equip them to meet the moment too is top of mind.
I'm a scientist. I'm also a parent, and I was a parent during COVID. And, you know, it was really striking to see the way my teenage children were picking up information and then transmitting and communicating with their peers. And, you know, I've also gone into high schools and talked about epidemiology and virology.
Oh,
and
good.
Things. You know, there's just a ton of interest there, and there's an incredible, you know, and they're incredibly adept with social media. So I'm wondering, one, like with your newsletter, are there youth, teenagers, and college students who are picking up on this? And the second is if you have any thoughts about the ways in which to engage youth in sort of the efforts you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, we've started thinking about this. I mean, I will just say my social media manager is like, I think she's like 20. She's like a Gen Zer. Like, she just knows this landscape. So like, one is just helping them help us, like figure out what the heck to do and how you do in vertical versus horizontal and whatever. I mean, Matt's been learning like from her a lot. So I think it's learning from them. I think it's asking them. I think it's engaging with them. I think it's also, no, you know, like those students or those that age doesn't want to get a newsletter in their inbox. They're on social media. So it's also meeting them where they're at too, and being very creative around it. I think one way to start engaging is schools. I mean, I don't know why we don't have an AP public health class. But man, we need to get one started. And I think that it's also, you know, talking about what they care about, right? A lot of this, you know, a lot of public health, you can be talking about vaccines and blah, 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 but like they really care about why their friend is having a mental health crisis or why they're so scared around Charlie Kirk's death or gun violence or, right, like really just listening to what their questions and confusions and concerns are and meeting them where they're at, I think is also a theme throughout this. No matter who your audience is, you have to ground in their reality and come to them.
My question is about, you have spent a lot of time like talking about the distrust and how public health can change, like as a community can change that, how epidemiologists, virologists can change that. But when I think about distrust of public health, I think for me and my family, it started like with doctors. And I think a lot of people have had really adverse experiences with doctors.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think that is like the most public-facing, like, science person that most people interact with. So how do you, as you're not a doctor, right? Like, you're a public health person. Like, how do you think we should, like, come at it from this angle when we have people being dismissed all the time by the healthcare system for one reason or another?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, they have the same exact problem. I think all of this could be applied to them. I think with medical professionals specifically, it's figuring out, even if they only have 10 minutes per patient, like how they can help create the world around them to be more flexible and more trustworthy too. One theme that I have learned from MAHA is every single person has been misled by the health system in one way or another, whether it's opioids, whether it's COVID, whether it's autism, no one listening to them. And so, you know, we need to create a health ecosystem that's beyond public health, and that is them too. And how do you do that when, you know, resources are so strapped, when health systems are so ingrained in for-profit things is, I think, one of the biggest challenges of our time. And I think that is why not only institutions like academics or NIH, but also so much distrust in the health system and health insurance and for-profit and pharmaceutical companies and all of that. I mean, we live in a for-profit health system, and that is not serving us well. How you do that, I think, is like the political question of the day. But it is starting to learn and recognize that the systems are failing people, plain and simple. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at UCTV.tv.